The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, in June of 2020, Catherine Zappone stepped down as Minister for Children and Youth Affairs. She was a latecomer to elected politics, first nominated to Shannadaran in 2011. But despite elected politics not being on her mind before that point, the seeds were sown in her work with her late wife Anne-Louise in the years after they both came to Ireland. And Catherine Zappone chronicles this journey alongside Anne-Louise in a memoir which is called Love in a Time of Politics. And Catherine is with me now. Good to see you again, Catherine.
And
thank you very
too,
much.
Pat. Thank you.
Now, in your prologue, you talk about how you met Anne-Louise.
Yes, that's
Remind me.
Yes, exactly. Well, in 1981, we both met in Boston College, where we started a doctoral program together. And I saw her walk in the room, and there were her green eyes and her lovely Irish lilt of a walk, as well as her voice, Pat. I mean, you know, you...
I remember her well.
Exactly. She loved you. Yes.
So you obviously got together... You became a man, or I was going to say man and wife, wife and wife.
yes.
Sorry for the
Not
Freudian
at all,
slip.
But you're allowed.
So then you decided, in spite of very successful careers, to come back to Ireland. Why?
Yes. That's right. Because, you know, this was home. I think one of the things that we learned so much about in terms of our doctoral work in education is that we wanted to really find ways to share that knowledge that we had with others. And that's when we set up in our own home an educational program, especially for women in West Tala.
Now, what did you actually do in that program and who came? There were some men involved.
Yes, there were some men, exactly. And we had a child care center in Jobstown. We had everything from, encouraging women to, learn about what their lives were like, gaining confidence, certainly literacy, and then moving on to other kinds of courses, which ultimately, as the organization developed, brought them onto a path of basically degrees in different areas that they would maybe want to study.
So that was a very successful. Now,
moving it's 40 years still almost, and it's still going.
Still yes. going strong.
Exactly.
Now getting into politics, you had a call.
I did. I had a phone call. I had a phone call from Eamon Gilmore. I had heard that I was going to get it from his advisor just about a half an hour before he rang. And I thought, oh, what's that about? And I thought, I'm in Grafton Street, and I better find a quiet place. So I slip into the Carmelite Church just off of Grafton Street, and Mass is going on, Pat. So I figure I'll go to one of the cells, the stairwells. And that's where Eamon rang me and asked me to was interested in joining the Shannon by being appointed.
He was in government at the time.
Enda Kenny, yes. So,
and he was offered by Enda Kenny the opportunity to nominate some
That's
senators.
Right, exactly.
Were you going to be a Labour senator or not?
Originally, I thought I would because he was asking me. And I had been a member of the Labour Party when under Pat Rabbit's leadership. But Eamon then rang me a couple of days later and said, no, Catherine, we want you to be an independent. It was an amazing time in politics then when there was, the government between the two parties had enough votes. So they said, we want you to be free and we want to have independent voices.
We can win all the votes we want to without you.
Yeah, that's what they said.
So you're free. What was your life like in Shannadaran? I mean, were you made welcome?
Absolutely. And I loved every moment of it. And Anne-Louise said to me when I got that job, she said, Catherine, everything you've been doing to, up to this point prepares you for that work. And I think that she was right. I'd been an academic. I'd been very focused on human rights. We were in the middle of taking our case against the Irish state because it wouldn't recognize our 2003 Canadian marriage. And I found it to be a place where it mattered that you could, maybe speak with a certain amount of authority. And if you worked hard to make your points, that it could make a difference. And then, Pat, I tell the story in the memoir, Love in a Time of Politics, that, in fact, that's one of the first chapters, is how I worked with a group of four incredible men to develop a campaign to save the Shannon.
Yeah, because it was under threat at that time.
It was under threat. And
too expensive, and what's it? But it's only a talking
shop.
Yeah,
talking shop. Well, I like to talk. And I think, the diversity of voices that came into the Shannon, we'd have more time to really reflect on what's going on. There's a lot fast paced that's going on in the Dáil. And it did allow us to have some check on the Dáil.
Yeah, and so the Shannon survives.
It survives. And I do tell the story of how I, working with the late Noel Whelan, the late Fergal Quinn, Michael McDougall, Joe O'Toole, and together we met for a year to develop a campaign to try to save it.
To save the Shannon. Yes. You know, it was described at one point as the best, I think it was Joe O'Toole who said it, was the best gentleman's club in Dublin.
Until a few of us women got there.
And, you know, there was car parking and everything.
Yeah,
was,
exactly. Well, I liked the car parking.
Fantastic thing. Now, being in the Shannon and doing the work that you did, what made the Doyle beckon?
Well, you know, it had just gone so well, and people started to encourage me to do that, and that maybe I could bring my voice into that chamber where you could, you know, really influence maybe the lawmaking and all those other things in a deeper way than what the Shannon had. And I wanted to represent the people from West Tala as well, where I just didn't think the policies that were coming out of the government before really reached their lives in terms of what could support them.
It's one thing to be in the Shannon, and I'm not saying that every senator is invisible, they're certainly not, but it's a quieter life than being in the Doyle.
It can be a quieter life, yes. I'm not so sure it was for me, as I said, conducting a big campaign, but you know, I did get into the Doyle. I barely scraped in, as
how,
I tell
how
the story.
Tight was it?
It was a couple hundred votes. And indeed, you know, again, I'm just a complete newcomer to that. And they called a recount. Fine Gael called a recount because it was their candidate that was leading the whole time. And they brought in their lawyers, these big gun lawyers, to kind of oversee the vote. And I had nobody. So I said, Anne-Louise, what are we going to do? And she said, why don't you ring Michael McDougall? Because we were great friends from the Shannon campaign. I pick up the phone and I say, you know, hi, Michael, how are you? It's Sunday morning. What are you up to? I'm reading the Sunday papers, Catherine. I said, would you come in to City West where the count center was? And sure enough, he came in and all of the cameras went to him. And then he, with the other fine gentleman, kind of look over to make sure everybody's proper.
Okay, and you got the seat.
And I got the seat on the 16th count.
Now, how do you become a minister then, so quickly?
Well, I had no sense, you know, about the ministry, the government, etc. But because of the way the numbers fell, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil didn't have enough to form a government, and so they started talking to independents. Are you interested in joining us? You know, Pat, it was later on in life for me, so I just made a decision. I wasn't sure if I wanted to stay on the opposition benches and protest for the next 4 or 5 years. And so I said, I'll talk to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. And that's what thus began my negotiations with effectively Fine Gael, you know, for a long period of time until I made a decision to vote for Enda Kenny as Taoiseach.
Now, you had an opinion of him that he was a Conservative.
I did.
And therefore you and he would not.
And I think he was a bit bad.
You know, that you and he would not see eye to eye on many social issues.
That's correct. And, you know, having said that, certainly early on in the Shannon, I sent him, and Louise and I had just put out our first book, Our Lives Out Loud. I sent him a copy. I get a ring from his private secretary to say he wants to see you. I go to his big office in government buildings, and we sit down on these big plus chairs in front of a fireplace, and he begins to quote to me word for word from memory two paragraphs from that book, and which bowled me over. And also I thought he was really a great Irish man and politician. And one reason is because he had an open mind. He was not for marriage equality at that stage. He listened, you know, to the arguments. He changed his mind and we won.
Now, we're talking politics, but this book is a love story.
It is a love story.
And it's also a story of heartbreak because Anne-Louise became very ill and relatively quickly. What happened to her?
Yes. Well, you know, as you say, it is the story is about, you know, I lose the love of my life as I, you know, while I had a big job. She had one brain hemorrhage when I was in the Shannon, which she recovers and was recovering from. And then I got into my ministry and she had had a second major brain hemorrhage and she landed in St. James's. One of the ways in which I try to mesh then the politics with that love, I tell a story about, you know, I was a minister. I had just left Leinster House. I went in to see her. She was, she was paralyzed all on the left side. She was blind. And I visited her one morning and I looked into her eyes and a vacant stare came back. And I thought, she's had another bleed. And am I the only one who can see it? And sure enough, later on, the hospital did a scan and she had one. And I just thought, you know, I had to go back to Leinster House, you know, later on in that afternoon. But it was the reason I made the decision to form what I called a healing team, her best, you know, some of her best friends, to really be there with her on a rotation basis until I could get later to her later in the evening.
Because you didn't think that there was enough monitoring of someone in her precarious position.
Well, she was monitored beautifully. The people were fantastic, in the and what was called the Misa Institute in St. James's. But she deserved to be accompanied for every moment. And when she would wake up, and she was often speaking French, and her lovely niece Hilda was there who could speak French back to her, I just wanted her to be accompanied.
Now, how debilitated was she from that point forward?
She was very debilitated. She never, she always had to be in a wheelchair. You know, and you could see as time moved on, you could see the kind of lines of vulnerability coming across her face. She had, though, her doctors said that she had a magnificent cognitive reserve, though, even at just before she passed away. So she was quite remarkable in that way. But she would move in and out of, a sense of the reality. And when she was with us, you know, I could chat with her. And there was one time, Joe Harbison, who was a great neurologist and healer, finally said to me, you know, she is going to actually pass away. She has a deadly disease, which you can't know about until maybe 10 days before someone passes. The brain is bleeding is the way he described it. And he said, when should we tell Anne-Louise that she's going to die? Or I asked him that, and he said, why not now? And we go to the room, and she's in her wheelchair, and she sits up. You know how she was, Pat. She had such grace and such a sense of authority. Now, she had, you know, a lot of blood on her brain at this stage, and several of the medics come in, and they talk to her, and they say, you know, what they say. And she said, okay, now, thank you so much, and I'm feeling a little tired. And then she wanted to go back to the bed, and she got in bed. And I went over to her afterwards, and I said, she asked me, Catherine, did Joe say that I was going to die? And I said, yes, Anne-Louise, that's what he said. And I said, Anne-Louise, are you afraid to die? And she said, I wasn't afraid entering this life, and I'm not afraid going out of it.
Now, her thoughts about her own funeral were not very, as you might expect.
I only got a little bit off of her when one of the moments when she had clarity and she said, no church, Catherine, I don't want any priests, you know, well, they might can be on the side, and it may be a public place. And then she said her father was many years owned the pub across from the Mansion House and the Dawson Lounge. And she said, you know, maybe the Mansion House. And so that's all I got from her.
That's all you got from her. Did pass, and you were bereft, and you
so
grieve for her every day.
Every day.
How has life been for you afterwards?
It's there have been lots of wonderful times and difficult times. I mean, I went to see my family after that. I decided to go to New York. I just wasn't sure, Pat, if it was the United States that I needed to go back to find. I was looking to find a home. And also, I knew that, you know, Anne-Louise wanted the best for me. She wanted my happiness, and that a primary relationship was always part of that. And, you know, I thought maybe I would find somebody else in New York.
And did you?
I did. I did. And I say a little bit about her at the end, and she's
gorgeous. I don't want to give too many spoilers.
No, exactly. We want to exactly have the people read it.
Well, the book is a wonderful read. It's called Love in a Time of Politics, subtitled A Memoir of Facing Loss and Finding Hope. It's written by Catherine Zappone, published by Hachette Ireland. Catherine, thank you very much for joining us in the studio
today. Thank you, Pat.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
On News Talk.